From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 1-800-NOW-OPEN or open.com.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The week after August 31st, 1997, was one of the most tumultuous in recent British history. It was right after Diana, Princess of Wales, died. Stephen Frears' new movie, The Queen, takes us inside the walls of Buckingham Palace and Balmoral in rural Scotland as the nation waited to see how its leaders would respond. The film stars Dame Helen Mirren as Queen Elizabeth II, and she is nothing short of amazing, earning her the Best Actress Award at the Venice Film Festival last month. The Queen opened the New York Film Festival on Friday. Now it's at theaters around the area, and I'm so glad that it has given me the opportunity to speak once again to Stephen Frears, the director, as well as Peter Morgan, who also won an award at Venice for Best Screenplay. He wrote the script. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You both had worked together earlier on a Channel 4 drama about the earlier history of Tony Blair and his pact with Gordon Brown. The show was called The Deal?
That's right.
Did that lead to this? Was that good preparation for this?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that was really about how Tony Blair became leader of the Labour Party, from whence he then went on to become Prime Minister. So, yes, there is a sense in which this began as a sort of sequel.
And that actually is timely because we're now seeing the end game of that deal.
That's right. Yes.
Why did so many directors pass on the deal initially?
Because the short answer is because there's a sort of tradition of depicting in drama our politicians, our leaders, only through satire. And I think a lot of people looked at it and thought, well, they just froze. They thought, well, this is a riveting story, and if they weren't to be called Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, this would be a really good story about friendship and betrayal. But they are called Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, and how the hell do I begin to do it? Do we veer into a world of impersonations, mimicry, and why aren't there more jokes?
Mm-hmm. And the same problem is present in this film, isn't it?
Well, no, because, I mean...
I mean, these are real people, and although there are some laughs,
yes,
in this film, there are no jokes.
So, in other words, the tone that that we established in the deal, whereby you do take these people and take them seriously as human beings, in fact, you know, make them as rounded and as flawed and as interesting and as vulnerable and as the rest of us... Once you have that sort of blueprint, you can then go on to take that sort of modus operandi into a story like this.
Well, when I must admit, when I first heard that Helen Mirren was in a film called The Queen, I thought, oh, she's doing Queen Elizabeth I again. Did people try to discourage you from doing this? Because
no, I don't think so. I mean, certainly not on an official level. There wasn't sort of threats to my life or anything like that.
Well, no, but she's still living. She's still the Queen of England.
I think the first question I did ask, are you allowed to do this? And they said yes. And, you know, we were hedged around with lawyers. And, the truth is you really behave responsibly. And I suppose people trusted me after the deal.
Part of the film is about how Queen Elizabeth lives a totally public life and yet remains a complete mystery.
Yes.
And that's because of the circumstances of the monarchy, or because, as you suggest in this film, there are certain traditions that she feels that she has to perpetuate.
It's part of the myth of the monarchy. You know, a man called Bagehot wrote in the 19th century about the royal about the monarchy having to have mystery, and that once you lifted the veil, somehow the magic would go, for which there's a certain amount of truth. The Queen would have been brought up absolutely in that tradition, but sort of really once her children came along and modern life came along, the game was kind of up.
And the tabloids have really invaded their privacy. It's kind of surprising to see her think that she couldn't maintain more privacy than
Well, it's the only time in my life that the Queen's ever been criticised, really. That you might say the only time in my life she's put a foot wrong. I mean, she did stumble that week for a moment.
Has she recovered? Because during the period that the film is about, the period when the British public was mourning Diana's death, one quarter of all the people polled said that they no longer were in favor of the monarchy.
Right now, she's more popular, she's more loved than ever. I mean, nothing. There'll be no change until maybe when she dies there'll be change, and maybe that'll be a good thing. But she's so admired and respected, and now she's an 80-year-old lady, so...
Except I think that's quite... I do think that's quite recent, and I think that something has happened even... I mean, something's happened certainly since 1997, in that I think she has now reached a sort of... that pantheon of sort of untouchables. I think now also, having turned 80 and so forth, I do now think that any sort of, not that there is much exciting Republican thought going on in England, it's mainly apathetic, but if there were to be, you know, sharp criticism of the royals, right now it would feel pretty undignified given her age and what she's done. Can I just also follow up on what you were saying? This business about remaining a mystery and so forth, I think one of the reasons why the film seems to have connected with people is that there is this sort of, she is both the crown and a woman. And as an institution, the crown is so powerful, symbolically. And I would imagine rather confusing for any person trapped in that position, you know, whereby, who am I? Am I the institution or am I a woman? Am I sovereign? Am I the crown or am I a mother, a wife, a sister, an aunt, a grandmother? And somewhere in giving herself quite as wholeheartedly as I believe she has to her, as it were, public duties, there's a sense that she might have neglected some of the private parts of her, and certainly that's what I like to think, which is what I wrote about in the film.
Well, the film humanizes her. We understand why she's acting the way she is, even if we may think she's making some mistakes. But we also see her in bed with the remote control, learning about what's going on by watching the news.
Well, I imagine she goes to bed. I imagine she watches television. There's no reason to think she lives different lives from the rest of us.
Well, how much of this is based on real fact? Because you have put words into the mouths of public figures. Everyone, I think, is a real person.
Mm-hmm. Well, some of what we know happened. You know, there's public record. So we know when they went to church. We know at what time. We know what was said. We know... And then, happily for the dramatist, there are whole swathes of the story which happened behind closed doors where absolutely nobody's got the faintest idea what was said.
Were you able to speak to people who might have given you an inkling?
Wherever possible, not. No, I mean, I did... I wrote what I wanted it to be, and then I showed it to people, and they would tell me where perhaps, you know, that was unrealistic, or she wouldn't say that, or oh no, that wouldn't be the procedure, that would happen rather than that. So, you know, but I think if, as a writer, I find if I take my lead from research, I get lost, because research is in itself, people's opinions are so partisan, and, you know, everyone's always in search of the truth, and the truth is so subjective. So I write what I would like it to be and then fact check.
My guests are Peter Morgan, who wrote the script for The Queen, and Stephen Frears, who directed the film. It's interesting that you've done two films in a row about women of a certain amount of mystery, Mrs. Henderson Presents,
yes.
and now this film.
Two women who were both the age my mother was when she died.
So did that give you some insight?
If I was an analyst, that's where I would start looking.
But did you think about your mother when you were directing this film and how she might have reacted to some of these situations?
I'm sure I did. I mean, my mother wore the sort of clothes that Judy wore in Mrs. Henderson Presents. And the Queen has just been part of our lives for... The Queen's been part of my life since 1947, I think. And, of course, that reminds me of my childhood and my mother, yes.
Well, this is... Diana's just died, and Diana had always been a problem for the Queen, which presents the royal family with a great, an even greater challenge when she dies. They cited traditions as the reason for their actions. Could it be possible that they're retreating, hunkering down in their country, in Balmoral, alone would have seemed more acceptable in the past? Or if Diana had just been some other former princess?
Well, I think they were quite quick. Look, I'm only going to speculate here. I don't know. But I imagine they would have been quite quick to bury their own feelings. And don't forget, they were dealing with Diana's children who were up there. And so I think it's entirely appropriate, actually, in times of great crisis and grief or whatever, to close the door. You know, don't forget, at the time, the media, the photographers, had been largely held responsible for Diana's death. Therefore, the idea that they should be locking the doors and keeping behind closed doors and away from the lenses of photographers seems entirely reasonable.
But you said that Diana's children would be one of the reasons. Queen Elizabeth, in your film, keeps saying that she's concerned about the children, spending time with them, but we never actually see her with them. She seems to be doing other things and is concerned with all sorts of things, like a stag that they're hunting. That seems to concern her a lot more than practically anything else that's going on.
I would agree with that. I mean, I personally, when I was writing it, I found it useful to use the as it were, the protection of the grandchildren as a convenient public screen behind which she could actually start to deal with some of the shock she was in herself. I think that the shock herself that she found herself in was less to do with possibly the death of Diana than to do with the fact that suddenly people, you know, she didn't recognize the country anymore. And it's worth bearing in mind that Britain was at a huge cultural and, you know, socio-political crossroads in 1997. There was a whole changing of the guard.
Tony Blair had just come to power.
And after 18 years of conservatives, you know, he, not only that, he came to power promising huge political and social reform. And so suddenly, you know, I like the idea of, again, with this one, if you were to strip away, you know, the fact that in the previous film it had been Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, if you, actually the human drama in this one seems to me about a woman who suddenly has reached an age where she quite possibly doesn't understand the world that she's living in anymore, which is an extremely human predicament.
And it's about two different kinds of power, one inherited and one elected, which also affects the way they view the world and view public opinion.
Well, of course, monarchy and democracy are contradictory, aren't they? Normally this is dealt with quite effectively by the by whatever passes for the British Constitution, since we don't have one written down. This was a week in which they banged against each other and there was a conflict. Behind all this is sort of the arrival of Diana in the middle of the royal family, which must have been very, very explosive when she turned out to be such a modern figure. You know, she was just a well-brought-up girl, but then all that love of pop music and her becoming like a sort of movie star, love, you know, Versace, people like that. When she sort of embraced pop culture, it must have come as a terrible shock to them all.
But she also did things that were admirable, and that's what the public seemed to remember.
By that time, the
landmines.
Yes, of course. Well, that was what was so contradictory about her, that she was both regarded as an angel, and clearly the royal family just saw her as this, as a completely different figure. Somebody much more manipulative, and someone who'd caused this trouble in their lives and in their position within the country. So she was a very divided person.
And you depict Tony Blair as being starstruck when he is dealing with the Queen.
Everybody is.
Well, except Sherry Blair, at least in your film.
That's true. That is true. But for the most part, I think there's, you know, there's a now generally accepted tradition that prime ministers, no matter what their political persuasion, just walk into that room and go to jelly.
Where were you on at this time? Maybe not on August 31st, 1997, but during this period.
I was in New Mexico making a Western.
so you were watching what was going on, the
bits,
flowers being put in front of Buckingham?
I saw bits
Buckingham.
On television, yeah. So I really missed the drama of the events.
I was getting married. And I was, you know, getting married abroad. So, to be honest with you, I missed out on most of it too.
But it's one of those events that you remember, rather, you know, like Kennedy's death. You know where you were when you heard the news.
And did you respond, do you think, with mixed feelings? Or did you have any insight into the situation?
No, I remember, I mean, all I remember was being startled by that it was such a dramatic event. I don't think the implications of it dawned on me.
My memory was, I wasn't surprised. Actually, I know that sounds like a ridiculous thing to say, but when I heard that she'd had this thing, I immediately thought, but her life had become so chaotic, so out of control. So if you actually have a look, which we did at one point, to do a time-passing section, we actually looked at what had happened in the 2 months leading up to Diana's death, and her behaviour had become so eccentric. You know, there were visits to clairvoyants in helicopters, she was smuggling boyfriends in the back of her car. She was chasing around. There were at least two other people that Dodi Fayed claimed to have, you know, claimed people's claims that he had proposed to them too. It was a real mess that was going on, and sometimes it takes tragedy to slow people down.
Now, Peter, you also wrote Last King of Scotland, which opened here recently, again about real people.
Mm-hmm.
Do you prefer writing those kinds of scripts, or is it just accidental that you did the television show about Tony Blair and then this, and also Last King of Scotland?
In each case, I suppose I've been, you know, trying to humanize monsters. And
do you think Queen Elizabeth is a monster? She just seems to be.
No, she's not a monster. But I these are people who, you know, Idi Amin had been reduced to a bunch of banal anecdotes, and you know, that deny both the complexity and the horror of the situation. And it's the same with the royal family, and it's the same with our prime ministers and our politicians. You know, people do these pen portraits, these sketches, and I don't know. I've been, you know, writing these unlikely love stories. You know, that's how I feel about them.
How do you go about casting a film like this? Was Helen Mirren immediately come to mind?
She was suggested to me by the producer, who also produces the cop show, Prime Suspect. So he must have seen her. And I think he came and said, oh, in a certain light, she looks like the Queen. And I was asked to meet Helen, I immediately thought, oh, that's a very, very good idea. So I never bothered to think about anybody else.
I love the scene where she's speaking with Tony Blair on the phone and she lines up her pens in a row. Is that something that just...
Not in the script.
To be fair, that's
that was
Helen.
Her?
That was Helen.
Helen.
Yeah.
Not only was it Helen, she came into the cutting room and insisted we put it in. I was very, very sceptical, and she was absolutely right. She kept saying, I've heard she's very, obsessive, compulsive, or whatever that combination of those words
obsessive,
is.
Obsessive, compulsive.
Yes.
Well, you could just try neat.
No, obsessive, compulsive.
Yeah, all right, let's
She must have asked
it.
People
she's a...
who said, oh, she's very obsessed with order.
Well, so, at the same time, she wants to do things that are like everyone else. She's always wearing a scarf over her head. She drives around in a Land Rover.
Rather than a Rolls Royce. Yes. Well, she's a sort of country woman, isn't she? A rich country woman.
Well, and also that generation of which my mother is also part. My mother's exactly the same age as the Queen. They are so averse to extravagance. You know, anybody who's gone through the war in the way that, you know, this generation has, I mean, you know, Stephen and I had this reference, you know, which is, you know, these people, they walk around the house turning off lights, you know, and buses went, and never complaining, never go to a doctor. Going to a doctor is a sign of absolute last resort.
And then there's a scene, in fact, after Diana's died, and Prince Charles suggests that he take the royal jet to France.
Yes.
Immediately, and she's suggesting that he fly
well,
coach, practically.
They were very sensitive to accusations of extravagance.
You also cast an American as Prince Philip, James Cromwell. Mm. There's an incredible physical resemblance. Was that the main reason?
No, the real reason, the real reason is that James Cromwell is a very, very good actor. But when I looked at English actors, the Duke of Edinburgh, the Prince Philip, he's a sort of joke in England. He's a sort of comic, part of the comic landscape, really.
And you depict him that way.
Yeah, but I tried to stop depicting him that way. Had I cast an English actor, had I cast Bill Nye or someone like that, it would have just been like a sort of pantomime, you know, dame coming on. You'd have just started to laugh as soon as he turned up.
Now, you didn't get an actress to play Diana.
No.
She was dead.
She was dead.
So you could just use newsreel footage in her case.
Yes.
But did you shoot everybody the same way? It seems to me you actually shot the Queen differently than the way you shot Tony Blair.
Yes, we shot the Queen. We shot Tony Blair on 16mm, Super 16, and we shot the Queen on 35mm because she is the Queen. I mean, she deserves 35mm.
So, but what effect were you trying to achieve?
Well, simply that, to distinguish between two classes. That, you know, one is a democratically elected politician, therefore we should treat him in a slightly more ordinary way than the Queen, who should be treated with greater respect.
How do you go about finding locations to shoot places that would look like the interiors, exteriors of Windsor Castle, Balmoral, and Buckingham Palace?
You just go on looking, and it takes a long time, and you put it together like a jigsaw. I mean, we shot all over the place and then somehow threaded them all together.
I understand you actually can stay on the grounds of Balmoral?
Yes, I didn't, but you can.
Did? I did, yeah.
Did that give you any inspiration?
One of the royal biographers gave us this tip. He said, and I have to do a posh voice because royal biographers speak far more posh than the royal family. He said, oh, you might consider. he said, there's something that very, very few people know. And he said, there's this tiny little sort of cottage which is in the middle of the estate, which they let out. And it's really not known. And so we went. And while we were up there, it was our extraordinary good fortune that the Queen decided to come up to Balmoral earlier than she had previously decided. But, of course, we weren't prepared to terminate our one-week rental. And so for 3 days, we were stuck inside the ring of security with the Queen in Balmoral. And that was really extraordinary.
It must have given you some insight.
I should say. Spectacular vegetable patches. And if gardening is your thing, and it's not mine, but you have never seen... There are 24 full-time gardeners in Balmoral alone. Do you have any idea what 24 gardeners can do to a place? It looks pretty astonishing.
What kind of response has the film received in England?
Well, quite extraordinary.
Any idea whether Tony Blair has seen it?
No, and I never will, or indeed whether the Queen has seen it. We'll never know that. But the response has been quite extraordinary. I imagine there'd be some people saying, look, this film shouldn't have been made. But in fact, it's been universal, the response.
Do you feel differently now about them after having made the film and thought a lot about how they might have reacted during this time?
No, I feel well... I feel well disposed towards elderly ladies. And she's clearly rather an extraordinary woman, the Queen. The truth is, that's what you become more and more aware of, how extraordinary she is. She's made the whole thing work. I would be very, very surprised if any of her children or grandchildren can make it work as well as she has.
I feel slightly guilty that we've left Blair in such a positive light, and that given what's happened in the past few years, it still feels like it must be unfinished business somehow.
Well, considering what's happened between Tony Blair and George W. Bush, opponents of the war might very well see the way he reacted to certain things during this time and the way he dealt with the Queen as being indicative or some kind of clue as to the way he would have acted later.
As the future conservatization of Tony Blair.
Well, and the idea of him swinging 180 degrees as he starts off the week speaking for Diana and ends speaking for the Queen. Yes, I would have thought that was really trying to express the complete change of his position.
And we do get a real sense of how he became more popular as a result of this. Use this, and you have a scene where the Queen says something rather ruefully about that. Well, Tony Blair came out of this looking very good.
Well, he did, and became, and of course the whole world was at the funeral, so he came out as a sort of world figure.
So are you working on other projects?
No.
What about you, Peter? No other people, well, other monsters you want
to make
films
about? Oh, I see. Yes,
about?
I have written another film about a British monster, Myra Hindley, the serial killer, and her relationship with Frank Longford, the aristocratic penal reformer, which sounds like an absolutely deathly pitch, but HBO has made it, and I'm rather proud of it.
Meanwhile, you have two films here in New York, Last King of Scotland and now The Queen. And thank you so much for coming by, Peter Morgan.
Thank you.
Stephen Frears, it's always a pleasure to see you. And
I hope
film.
I'll be back.
Well, you're always welcome
getting
here.
Old.
And I just can't rave enough about the performance that Helen Mirren gives. In fact, everybody, but Helen Mirren is just an amazing actress. Thanks again.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.